Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Welcome to After Things, where we talk about being a creative, doing creative things, making a living at that, and trying to do that. I'm Andrew Main. Joining me is Mr. Bryce Castillo.
Hi, everybody. How's it going?
Brian has to go do a show, and Justin is...
Sick. He got a little sick.
Yeah, we hope he's feeling better. Yes, he was in the middle of the show and got sick. So,
yeah. Best wishes to...
Yes, yeah, sorry. It's one of those things that your buddy are like, man, well, we'll have an update on that. I was cracking jokes about Zika, and look what happens. It's not funny.
Yeah, jeez, the Andrew Main curse.
Learned my lesson. So Bryce is sitting in. He's in the Chewbacca seat right now, and what we're going to talk about is we're going to do an episode of Weird Tank on After Things. So it's funny, I realized today that we called it Weird Tank, although it's on After Things.
It's on After Things. Well, because I think we you guys talked about it on Weird Things, mm-hmm. maybe? And then, I don't know. Yeah.
So this is the way it works. If you have a business or some strategy or something that you're approaching and you want us to consider, to give you our input on it. And again, we'll be the first ones to tell you we're not experts. Just take us as just some other person weighing in with a point of view on that and nothing more than that. We don't want to ruin any lives, but we will take credit when it helps out. So we've got a response here. This is from Andy Morris, and he says, "Howdy guys. So I'm a science teacher and a wannabe sci-fi fantasy writer, which has led to my current dilemma. I've spent countless hours writing, mainly because I enjoy doing it. I've tried self-publishing a few things on Amazon, but I know without spending some money to get serious editing and professional cover art and just getting better at writing, the chances of anything making money are pretty slim. On the other hand, last year I started posting learning materials I've created for use in my science classes to a popular website where teachers can buy other teachers' materials. It's called teacherspayteachers.com. If you don't mind the buzz marketing, happy to promote that. Last semester alone, my products, about 20 items, made me over $1,000, and pretty much every product has a 5-star review, which is 2 or 3 stars higher than my stuff on Amazon. As a father of 3, full-time teacher, and part-time bouncy house delivery man, I have a limited amount of time to devote to my creative endeavors, mainly when everyone else in the house is sleeping. One choice is to spend it writing, because I like doing it, with the side chance that maybe someday I'll actually make something worth selling. Or should I spend the time cracking out learning materials to post to the teacher site instead? My learning materials are objectively better than my writings and actually make me real money, but I haven't really spent much time creating anything new to post. Should I focus on what I'm good at and can make money doing, or do what I'm passionate about, even if it will probably never lead to much? I know I can do both and find some happy medium, but if you had to choose, which direction would you lean? Thanks for any advice."
Man, that's like the time-tested question, right? Do you do what you love, or do you do what you think works?
Absolutely. And first off, Andy, I got to tell you this. You are very, very lucky that you have found some creative medium that has traction. Traction's the term I use to apply when something finds an audience, when something makes you money, when something you create has some effect on reality around you. And the fact that your teaching materials are doing this is wonderful. That's absolutely wonderful. I think that's great. I think that by all means, you should pursue that. I would say a comparison for me would be when I wrote books on magic and how to do magic. And I spent a number of years, I went from performing to wanting to have more time to pursue other projects. So I started writing these how-to books, creating magic tricks and doing that. And that became a pretty lucrative business for me enough that I was able to support myself doing that. But I knew there was a limit to how often I'd be able to put these books out and how many of them I wanted to do. I just put out a new magic book a few months ago, Magic and Mischief, but I've only put out one in the last few years. It's still something I like to create. I'll probably be creating more magic books in the future, but I like to write fiction more than that. I also like to do my new how-to books, like my book How to Write a Novella in 24 Hours is fun. I'm doing one on Writer's Block. I would say that it comes down to there are two factors in place. If you need the money and you have this thing that makes money, do that first. That should be your primary goal, particularly as a father who's got kids and you need to do that. If it's just, hey, it's more of a fun money kind of thing and you do it because of that, then write some teaching stuff, write some fiction. I'm going to take a look at your, let me see if I find you up on Amazon, see if you're under that name. And I'm going to give you some advice, though. As far as getting your fiction edited and all that, there are different ways to go about doing these things. It's certainly, you don't have to spend anything if you want to do something. What you have to do is spend time. So I see a few books here. I presume they might be you by Andy Morris. They don't even have covers.
Yeah.
It is extremely easy to get covers done for a book. You don't have to spend anything really to get that. If you go to, let's say, let's try Canva.com or Canva. What's the web? Yeah, Canva.com is an easy way to start designing book covers. You can go sign in for there, and you can create covers in a, you know, really, really quickly. You can use just pre-existing album art or pre-existing artwork. Drop your own text over that. Covers, if you put a little bit of time into it, aren't that difficult. If you check out my book, How to Write a Novella in 24 Hours, it's only 99 cents. Just email me if you want. I'll just send you a copy. I'm not really trying to make money off you from that. I go into, you know, how to create quick and dirty, cheap covers. I created, you know, 5 covers in there that I think would be good enough to be in a bookstore very easily using a simple formula. So that's not hard. Editing is hard. Editing takes time and it takes patience. I just did a massive edit of Station Breaker where I had hundreds of people on my email list send me in their corrections. And I was always going to find, you know, different, you know, I'm going to continuously find new things that need to be fixed, which is the same when I pick up a Stephen King book and I'll find grammatical mistakes and these sort of errors. That'll happen in any release. But my point is, you can either have a dedicated person you pay to do this. You can have a bunch of people do this. And if you don't have that access to a network, then you do it. You take your time with it. I have a printer next to me that I print my books out on when I want to go line by line and check my own spelling, my own mistakes. That's the way I do it. I have to change the medium that I wrote it so that my face, you know, that my brain is in a different place than where my face was looking at. So you can get it edited. You can get a cover design. You don't have to spend money to do it. It just takes time. So let's say that's out of the question now. Comes down to, doesn't matter money. But it doesn't mean they're going to be good books. And you feel like you're writing better books in that space than you're creating your teacher materials. At least that's what it sounds like. There's an expression called a million words, which means that as a writer, you know, maybe you should have a million words under your belt before you, you know, start to publish. And we had a JF on our show before who talked about all the books he wrote that he never released. In the era of digital publishing, it's very easy to take the first thing that comes out of your keyboard and put it online. That's a mistake. That's not a good idea because it's not going to be as good as the thing that happens after your millionth word, and that reaction to that first thing you put out there is going to affect your experience on everything else you do.
Well, especially compared to something that is a little less high profile, like with the chat realm, we get a lot of people who are interested in podcasting because we're all centered around these different podcasts. And with that, my advice usually is just to do it because that's something that you're probably not going to charge people for. It's something that you need to have a lot of writing under your belt. You need to have a lot of airtime, a lot of mic time to get your public speaking, your on camera look, you know, you need time to do it. And that's the thing where if you make a podcast for, you know, yourself or for nobody, then that I think helps less than something like putting out, you know, the first thing that you write.
Absolutely, Bryce. And that's the problem is that we see the things that we see as an audience. We're coming into the middle of it. You know, we're not seeing it to the starting stages because at the starting stages, there isn't an audience. Every time I sit down and I do a podcast with Brian and Justin and then I listen to it, I can tell the difference between those guys who do 4 or 5 podcasts a week and myself who does 1.5 podcasts a week. I can tell the difference of I got into podcasting the same time Justin did, roughly the same time as Brian did, but I never did more than one podcast a week where those guys, you know, they're 5 times ahead of me, 6 times ahead of me, and I can tell the difference from that. Okay. And I would say that for anybody wanting to get into that, whether it's writing or podcasting, you have to appreciate that there's that, we've talked about this before, there's that gap between when you're aware of what's good and what's bad in where you are, your self-assessment ability is way off, where you don't really accurately assess your capabilities. Sometimes we go headfirst into that. We think this is good. We think it's great. We put out in front of everybody, and all people point out are the flaws, and then we think, oh, man, it sucks. I shouldn't do it. Well, no. It means you just got to work on the flaws. You got to work on that, making that better. And that's the hard part. The hard part is saying, oh, I don't get to start off at the same spot that the people I like or admire or aspire to be. I have to start at the point where they started at, which you never saw.
And so to bring it back to the writing on the opposite end, much like with the podcast where you mentioned people will come in the middle of it and very rarely go all the way back and listen to all your mistakes and flubs. But with writing, it's a much lower clip than podcasting. So you're going to get more people who are like, oh, I really like this most recent book of yours. Let me go back. Oh, this old book is not so great. It's like it's a density problem, right? Like one bad book is going to last a lot. Is going to count from your library of work much larger for much longer than a podcast, which you could do more commonly. So being selective about what you put out is incredibly important on low volume releases like that.
Yeah, and you have too an advantage that comes into play when you first do something like a podcast. You're often just super energetic and excited. You know, my first novel, Public Enemy Zero, if I were to try to write it today, I would write it very differently. And I don't know if that would make it better. What that book had was an excitement and an enthusiasm that is very obvious when you read the book that makes up for a lot of the early writer mistakes that I made. And not to say that I don't make entirely new mistakes now, but you know, that's one of the things. Enthusiasm can carry through a lot. And that's often what happens with sometimes you'll have writers who come out with amazing freshman efforts because it's a thing they've been thinking about for 10 years. They put it out there and they may have learned some technical craft, but they become better storytellers, but they don't have better stories to tell. Mm. That happens in music. We talk, the sophomore slump is a real thing where you're like, now I'm going to go do this next thing. And I didn't think about it as much as I did the other thing. And it's not going to be as good.
Yeah. Especially in sort of the more traditional avenues like music or books where you've spent 10 years coming up with your initial idea, and then you get a contract, and then you suddenly have to have another album in 12 months.
Mm-hmm. Whereas in podcasting, often you can be so excited about something that becomes infectious and carries through, and that's part of perhaps the content. But yeah, it's when you sit around all day listening to podcasts, you tend to start thinking, like, maybe I need to do a podcast. Mm-hmm. But the problem you have in podcasting is the same you have in publishing. And the thing to think about is that every year there are 2 million more books published digitally.
Wow.
Used to be 10, 15 years ago in the publishing market, you had the traditional publishers were putting out 200,000 books a year. 200,000 books a year was arguably too many books. No, it was impossible for one single human being to read that many books, and nor would they be expected to, but that was just a ridiculous amount of books. Now you have 2 million digital titles put out a year. What that means, and this is one of the things that kind of got overlooked in the talk about the idea of the long tail, which Chris Anderson wrote a very interesting book that made some very cogent points on it, but I think was off quite a bit, was the idea that, well, you create these things and then you have a long tail where you can sell for years and years and years. Yeah, that's true. But when you're in an environment where every year there's 2 million more things coming out to compete with it, that long tail is very, very skinny. And I have books that, you know, Public Enemy Zero was a very big seller for me. It was a very, very big book. But there's, you know, the long tail on that is minuscule. It's minuscule. I move a couple copies a month, but I'm not actively promoting it. And it doesn't, in an environment where every month there are thousands of thrillers and techno thrillers being put out there, no matter how good it is, it's still going to get lost in all that noise because it's just layers and layers and layers of ice pack keep growing on top of it. And that's the thing you have to consider is that it's shorter windows. There's all that other thing, all that other stuff competing out against there. And my business advice to Andy is you have a lot of traction with these
teaching writing materials.
What's that?
The teaching materials that he
absolutely he's that you're going to probably have your efforts there will be much more rewarded probably than in ebooks. I don't know what the ceiling is though. The reason I went from writing magic books to sci-fi to then writing techno or writing thrillers for general audiences is I looked at what the size of the audience was. I said, how can I appeal to as many people as possible? And I went from sci-fi books that sold 10,000 copies to thrillers that sold hundreds of thousands of copies. And I'm like, ah, I get that. So, yeah. But that's not a problem to really worry about, to be honest with you, is that there are sci-fi writers who are doing fantastically well by writing really broadly and deeply in their genre. George R.R. Martin only writes these fantasy. I mean, he's written a lot of different kinds of books, but when he settled into writing fantasy, mm-hmm. he wrote the fantasy book. We've talked about Andy Weir. Andy Weir wrote one book, one sci-fi book, The Martian, and it's done pretty damn well for him.
Yeah. And it's it kind of is like a Glengarry Glenn Ross thing. Like you got something that is working for you. I think at least for right now, it behooves you to see what happens if you invest more time into that and see if you continue getting a return on that. Maybe a little more time will push it up exponentially. Maybe you just won't get, it'll be diminishing returns. But of the two options you have right now, you know, you're going to have to weigh if the money coming in from the teaching materials is worth your time, and if your time can be more devoted to that. Otherwise, you know, you can say maybe it's not worth the money and I'd rather hone my writing craft. You know, that's kind of the balance that he's going to have to find on his own.
Absolutely. But it's, I think that you can also say to yourself, what do I enjoy about writing that I can put into this other thing? And that often can make it worthwhile. Mm-hmm. And there's no reason to say that you can't say, hey, you know, for a couple hours every Sunday, you're going to work on your sci-fi book. But the universe has spoken to you and told you, hey, this thing seems to be really well. It's going to be a lot more easy for you to compete there than it is going to be competing in the book space, where it's not so much a matter of money as much as time and energy and all that. Here I am with Station Breaker launching, and I'm emailing podcasts and places saying, hey, have me on as a guest. I'd love to be a guest because I've got to go spend a ton of time pushing that book out.
Yeah.
But it should be worth it. So, yeah. Was that our question for the day there? Or
That I believe is the one that I've gotten since then. Yeah.
Sweet. So if any of you want us to try to approach or talk about what you're working on, send it to
me. Go to neshcom@gmail.com, neshcom@gmail.com.
All right. Do you have any picks? Have any recommendations?
I do. I was talking about this before the show, but I will keep it spoiler free because it's still pretty recent. I like puzzle games, right?
Mm-hmm.
I have kind of a weird sort of taste in video games. I like puzzle games. I like music game, sort of not alternative, not necessarily indie, but I won't try to describe it, but there's a new game that came out about a month or so ago called The Witness. This is from Jonathan Blow. He made Braid, which came out a few years mm-hmm. ago, which is a time travel game. This is I think The Witness is the height of puzzle execution in a video game. You have it starts off simple, where you have these panels where you are solving line puzzles, and as you go through the game, you learn more and more logic rules about what different elements of the puzzles affect how you're supposed to solve them, and it does it completely non-verbally, not with no communication, and the thrill that you get from realizing I just learned something and I was able to apply it, and the relief of like of breaking through whatever that logical hurdle is incredibly thrilling. Like I playing this had me like literally screaming in some cases because of how ingenious it is at not just getting you to learn things, but also managing your expectations of like, you know, you're solving these puzzles and then you might see a thing, which I won't spoil, but you might see a thing and then you realize, oh my God, the scale of what I thought this game was has tripled, because of these new discoveries. I think it's fantastic, and I just finished like the second one of the toughest parts of the game, and the messages that it conveys about learning and logic and also just meditation and sort of mindfulness even, I think are also just really nice. And I think it's great if you like puzzle games. I've been telling, when people ask about it, I say, do you like puzzle games? And if they say no, I say, you don't want to play it.
Yeah, this looks utterly beautiful. I was a kid who spent so much time in the world of Myst because that was such a, all-inclusive sort of universe that was, talk about something just like pushing the upper limits of what the technology could do at the time.
Yeah.
But I'm looking this up right now.
And what I think in that vein is that The Witness is a really gorgeous game, and it's able to hide intricate details within graphical elements that in the past would have just been like procedurally generated or random. Mm-hmm. And so it actually is able to use a really high fidelity of visuals to inform how you solve some of the puzzles. I think it's really great. And I know it's a $40 puzzle game, but it's also the most fun I've had in a very long time.
What platform are you playing it on?
I'm playing it on PC. It is also on the PS4.
Interesting. The HTC Vive, they've announced that that's going to go on sale in April, I believe.
Yeah, for like $800.
Yeah, but $800.
You also get the controllers and the laser tower thing, right?
Yeah, so it'll come with the headset, the controllers. It'll come with the sensors that tell you spatially where you are in a room. And I got to tell you, man, I have one of the Oculus dev models, but playing with the Vive, because the difference with an Oculus is that an Oculus is great for standing and sitting in front of your PC with the sensor telling you where your head is pointing. It's the difference between having your head fixed on a stick and really moving around with the HTC Vive. And I'm going to have a lot of trouble resisting buying that with a PC gaming package, because the experience I had with it was just insane, absolutely insane.
Yeah. Did you pre-order an Oculus? What's your first what do you think is going to be your first step, purchase wise into the space?
I mean, I've had an Oculus for over a year.
Oh right, okay.
Yeah, I've had a dev model. I played with it, plug it into the game engines and stuff, and doing stuff like that. But I my frustration from Oculus, one, in the middle of working on it, they stopped doing Mac support, which told me it's going to be totally a gaming device.
Right.
Which, and then the control, like they had no answer for controllers. Like, oh, we're going to have third party, and that obviously because they're selling the Oculus without controllers, and they're going to ship later on. And I thought that, like, man, yeah, if I wanted a better way to play Call of Duty, if I wanted to be a better way to be inside of a game, and look around, Oculus sounds cool. But if I want that really different virtual experience where I really feel like I'm in the holodeck, when I did the Vive, that was it. Because it's just, it's hard to explain the difference, but it's one is seeing the world from having your head in a fixed position and rotating around and looking at it. The other one is walking around a space and you move, not telling a little controller to move you forward, not telling like you're not using a joystick to move you, but just walking and having the sensors on the wall know where you are. If you get too close to a wall, a grid appears in front of you and tells you to back up.
Oh, wow.
Absolutely insane. I mean, I didn't feel like I was in a game. I felt like I was in another dimension.
And, I think it's good that there's that dichotomy of what each device is aiming at, because definitely gaming is going to be a huge element of VR. And when you have something like Oculus, which I guess, are they going to make controllers for the Oculus, or are they just
Have controllers for it, but they just, they're...
But basing it, letting the consumers use, the Xbox controller, which is one of the biggest ones for PC gaming... having that compatibility built in is definitely a big gaming thing, right? Like,
yeah,
you can get this thing and it works with all the stuff that you have, but also knowing that the Vive is going to have its own controllers, which are meant for a certain type of interactivity. It's great that both of those spaces are being filled between these two products.
Yeah, I don't know what an Oculus does that a Vive can't. You know, and Vive is more. It's more expensive. But my gosh, that free roaming capability, kids. Oh my God. Yeah. It's one, the difference was Oculus for me was sitting on the edge of a pool, leaning over the edge of the pool and sticking your head underwater and like, I'm in the water. Vive was just jumping right in and walking around. So, yeah. But what an exciting point we live in. So, and now we've got Google has announced that they're going to take cardboard and make a full all-in piece of hardware that you don't have to plug your phone in. That will be a standalone piece of hardware using their own room mapping technology.
Huh.
Like, to be honest with you, like, if we had was Oculus, I wouldn't get it. I mean, I'd get
really?
Vive because of the experience. Oh. Yeah, because like it's just the next gen stuff with free roaming is so much better.
Yeah.
So much more. It's not a matter of the resolution's better. It's a difference between you having to sit in your chair and pretend you're there or standing up and walking around in that version, the snow crash reality.
And, you know, I think I've been kind of cold on virtual reality, but also I haven't had a great chance to play with any of them for a really significant amount of time. But I think part of it is because of sort of the Oculus thing where that's kind of an iterative addition where
just a bigger monitor,
a bigger jump, right? I think that would be something great to see to try out as the next step in this platform.
Yeah, it's exciting. My pick is HBO's show Vinyl. Have you seen this?
No, I've been seeing a lot of the promos for it. You like it? Well, I mean, you're picking
it. I do. The premiere episode, it was funny because I forgot everything I knew about it going into it. And the premiere episode, it's set in 1973. It's set within the music industry. And I thought it was good. Parts of it were a little bit like, this feels a little bit laggy or whatever. But ultimately, I very much enjoyed it. And then I realized, Martin Scorsese directed this. Mm-hmm. It's set in the world of music in 1973 with this music company, the American Century Music. It stars, I think, Bobby Cannavale, who has been Boardwalk Empire, played, I think, great roles in there. Mm-hmm. He is the head of the music company, and it's very much what is the music industry like at that point. And this is a series that is Martin Scorsese, Mick Jagger, contributing stories to it. So what's cool about this is like I loved Almost Famous, but Almost Famous had to be very careful and sort of dance around who these stories were about. Because, you know, if they name names, it could be problematic. We're here. They have permission. They're doing it full on. So in the opening, one of the things in the pilot episode is this music company is trying to sign Led Zeppelin. So they're backstage at Led Zeppelin, and there's a young Robert Plant there who's, you know, acting very Robert Plant-like. And there's the manager of Led Zeppelin who's a notorious, loud, loud man. And they're there. And part of a reoccurring point of this is this the lead character going to a concert by the New York Dolls, which the event that happens is fictitious, but the New York Dolls were a very real influential band in the music scene in the early 1970s. And so it's so cool that they're using real bands. So you're getting a taste of what music was like at that time. The stories are not all accurate,
yeah,
but it's still based in reality.
Is the main character supposed to also be a real person? Is this supposed to be semi nonfiction? Where
I don't know. You know, my knowledge of that era of music of who some of the characters are. I know about, you know, who Ahmed is and some of the other players in it, but I don't know. The short answer is that it would not surprise me if he was based on a real person, but yeah. We can find that out. We have the power to do that.
Because it's almost because it reminds me a little bit of sort of the premise of like The Newsroom, where it's like real events, but it was fake people reporting on the news as if it were happening to them at the same time and they existed, but they don't. And the problem with that was that it got extremely preachy of just like, we are going to report on the Gulf oil spill immediately better than everyone. And we're going to give it focus and no one else does. Like, That was a real issue that the newsroom had. But if this is
no, it's not a real guy. That show is not for me. Most of the main characters are composites or just totally new creations.
Okay.
Which, you know, because part of what happens here is somebody would get very litigious because of some of the things that take place. But the bands, most of the bands, though, are, you know, you can tell, like, oh, I don't think this is a real band because, you know, they're going to be a main part of it. But, you know, they can show up backstage at Led Zeppelin and have something happen that's probably not going to piss them off. But, the closest example they talk about is the founder of Atlantic Records, Ahmet Ertegun. But he's mentioned in there, but he's clearly not him. But he probably might be somewhat similar, although Mick Jagger says no.
Interesting. Very cool. So that's HBO, right?
Yeah, HBO. Yeah.
One episode out already. Two.
Two is on tomorrow, I believe.
Okay. Very cool. Yep. Tonight. Wait, is it a Sunday show?
Tonight. Sorry. Tonight, yeah. Sorry. I was doing a time travel experiment earlier and I forgot. I jumped into Sunday. So.
Right.
I got to go back to Saturday in a few minutes though. It's been after.
Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.